From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Shay Zeller, and this is The Front Porch. If you were a real stickler, you could say that Donald Hall is from away, but by now he's come to symbolize the quintessential New Hampshire poet. He moved to the state more than 30 years ago, to the farm his grandparents owned on Eagle Pond in Wilmot. And it's a place that would provide a backdrop for much of his poetry and his life. It was the farm he visited all through his childhood, and the place where his wife, the poet Jane Kenyon, would pass away. Hall settled in New Hampshire to write, and write he did, dozens of books, awards, and honors later. Donald Hall's newest collection is White Apples and the Taste of Stone. It's selected poems that reflect his entire career, poems written between 1946 and 2006. Donald Hall is here with us today to talk about his poetry and how it's changed over the years. Welcome back to The Front Porch.
Glad to be here, Shay.
The title of this book comes from your poem, White Apples. Would you mind reading it for us?
I'm happy to. White Apples. When my father had been dead a week, I woke with his voice in my ear. I sat up in bed and held my breath and stared at the pale closed door. White apples and a taste of stone. If he called again, I would put on my coat and galoshes.
That's Donald Hall reading his poem, White Apples. So what does white stone taste like?
It's pretty bleak, and it hurts your teeth, and it doesn't taste very good. I mean, this is, Bill Moyer suggested that I was thinking about funerary architecture. And it's true that I was living backed up to a graveyard at that time, and might even have seen it when this line came into my head. But I began the poem 17 years before I got that line, 17 years before I finished it. Every now and then I'd pull it out, and I know it was incomplete. It was just the anecdote then. And then this line came into my head one afternoon, and I knew it belonged with this poem. And of course, I put it in. It doesn't fit syntactically. It's just suddenly there in the middle of the poem. But for me, it does the mood, the feeling, the elegiac feeling, and the feeling of emptiness, coldness. I won't explain it, you know, going through white apples, taste, tone, etc. But it's just there. And when I got it and attached it to this poem, I knew finally I had it after all these years.
Now, listeners may associate your recent work with the death of your wife and fellow poet Jane Kenyon, but I find that your father's death is pervasive in your writing.
Yes.
Why is his death, more than anybody else in your family, the one that comes up again and again?
I was 27 years old. He was 52. Many people have lost parents earlier than that, but it was pretty early. I had already written about the death of his mother, and I had written about the death of my grandfather. I'm a fairly elegiac poet. One time I was at a fundraising dinner for the Boston Public Library, and one of the husbands of the woman who raised the funds said, "What do you write about?" And I said, "Love, death, and New Hampshire." With some of them, I can write about love in New Hampshire or death in New Hampshire. Well, my grandfather was my great love of my early life when I was a kid, and I wrote an elegy for him. And then my father. And my father's death was very poignant to me because I had grown up with him, obviously, and I was very aware of his disappointment in his life. He was very kind to me, and he looked up to me. He sort of, left it up to me to do what he hadn't done. But he was very conscious of what he had not done, of being, he would have called it a failure. He worked for his father and didn't really like working for his father. And that's disappointment, that sense of disappointment in his life, which I was determined to avoid.
You've outlived
filled my
him.
Poems about him.
You've outlived him. Your son is about to surpass his age.
My son will be his age when he died, and my son is very healthy.
And do you feel like in some way you need to write on behalf of your father, too?
Oh, definitely. And I was right. My first book came out a couple of weeks before he died, and he was so proud. I mean, I was fulfilling a kind of ambition that he lacked entirely. And I lived with that burden. I felt guilty toward him because I was conscious of his disappointment more than of his positive qualities.
I'd like to have you read another poem, one that really struck me as soon as I heard you read it. And I guess I'm not alone. I guess a lot of people like this poem. It's called Names of Horses.
Yes. I'll find it in my book here. Names of Horses. All winter, your brute shoulders strained against collars, padding and steerhide over the ash hames, to haul sledges of cordwood for drying through spring and summer, for the gunwood stove next winter, and for the simmering range. In April, you pulled cartloads of manure to spread on the fields, dark manure of Holsteins, and knobs of your own clustered with oats. All summer you mowed the grass in meadow and hayfield, the mowing machine clacketing beside you while the sun walked high in the morning. And after noon's heat, you pulled a clawed rake through the same acres, gathering stacks, and dragged the wagon from stack to stack, and the built hayrack back uphill to the chaffy barn, three loads of hay a day hanging wide from the hayrack. Sundays you trotted the 2 miles to church with the light load of a leather quarter-top buggy and grazed in the sound of hymns. Generation on generation, your neck rubbed the windowsill of the stall, smoothing the wood as the sea smooths glass. When you were old and lame, when your shoulders hurt bending to graze, one October the man who fed you and kept you and harnessed you every morning led you through corn stubble to sandy ground above Eagle Pond and dug a hole beside you where you stood shuddering in your skin and laid the shotgun's muzzle in the boneless hollow behind your ear and fired the slug into your brain and felled you into your grave, shoveling sand to cover you, setting goldenrod upright above you, where by next summer a dent in the ground made your monument. For 150 years, in the pasture of dead horses, roots of pine trees pushed through the pale curves of your ribs, yellow blossoms flourished above you in autumn, and in winter frost heaved your bones in the ground, old toilers, soil makers. Oh, Roger, Mackerel, Riley, Ned, Nellie, Chester, Lady Ghost.
You managed to get love, death, and New Hampshire all in one, all in one poem.
Absolutely.
You managed to find romance in these really harsh realities of New Hampshire farm life, of an era gone by.
I loved it so much. I was born in 1928, and I first visited the farm in 1928. I was 6 weeks old, but my memory of that is imperfect. But all the time when I was going to school in Connecticut and when I was in college, I would spend my summers. As soon as school got out, I'd get on the train and come up to the farm. I loved the old people, my grandfather and my grandmother, who were totally lovable, wonderful people. And my grandfather, who'd hadn't had much schooling, memorized poems. But it was poems like Casey at the Bat, or that was the literary height of his repertoire. He was a great speaker of pieces. And so while he was milking the cows with his hands, he would bellow out his long poems, melodramatic and funny and all sorts of things. I never wrote that kind of poem. I never wanted to or tried to. But I did have an introduction to one kind of poetry by my grandfather.
This is The Front Porch. I'm Shay Zeller, and in just a minute, we're going to have more with poet Donald Hall. This is The Front Porch on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Shay Zeller. My guest today is writer Donald Hall. He's the former poet laureate of New Hampshire, and he's written scores of books of prose and poetry. His latest book is called White Apples and the Taste of Stone. It's a collection of poetry that spans his 60-year career, and the book also comes with a CD of Hall reading his work. Here's the poem, To a Waterfall.
Women with hats like the rear ends of pink ducks applauded you, my poems. These are the women whose husbands I meet on airplanes, who close their briefcases and ask, what are you in? I look in their eyes. I tell them I am in poetry. And their eyes fill with anxiety and with little tears. Oh, yeah, they say, developing an interest in clouds. My wife, she likes that sort of thing. I guess maybe I'd better watch my grammar, huh? I leave them in airports, watching their grammar, and take a limousine to the Women's Goodness Club, where I drink Harvey's Bristol Cream with their wives, and eat chicken salad with capers, with little tomato wedges. And I read them The Erotic Crocodile and Eating You. Ah, when I have concluded the disbursement of sonorities, crooning, high on thy thigh, I cry high, and so forth, they spank their wide hands, they smile like jello, and they say, my goodness, Mr. Hall, but you certainly do have an imagination. Thank you indeed, I say, it brings in the bacon. But now, my poems, now I have returned to the motel, returned to l'éternel retour of the Holiday Inn, naked, lying on the bed, watching Godzilla Sucks Mount Fuji, addressing my poems, feeling superior, and drinking bourbon from a flask disguised to look like her transistor radio. And what about you? You laughing. You in the blue jeans. Laughing at your mother who wears hats, and at your father who rides airplanes with a briefcase watching his grammar. Will you ever be old and dumb like your creepy parents? Not you, not you, not you, not you, not you, not you.
That's Donald Hall reading his poem To a Waterfowl. It's from a CD that accompanies his new collection of poetry. It's White Apples and the Taste of Stone, selected poems that span his 60-year career. Donald Hall, your poetry as a body is 60 years old, and like your children are all grown up. Do you look at yourself now and see the ways in which they've taken after you? I think of that line, will you ever be old and dumb like your creepy parents?
My kids are not literary. They read a lot, but they don't write. They're not writers. The grandchildren, there are five grandchildren, and a couple of them have some interest in writing, I think. I'll be fascinated to watch. There are two 17-year-olds who'll be going to college in the fall. It's very exciting.
Well, as you look at your child, your body of work, who is now 60 years old, how have you seen it evolve and change and grow?
Oh, I've seen it evolve and change a great deal. Every now and then I've gotten myself into a style that seemed to me very hopeful and produced a lot of poems, and then I'd use it up. And then I would waffle around trying to find really a way to make a new noise. The sound of poetry is sort of my doorway into it. And every time my style has changed, it's changed in the way its rhythm and its characteristic vowels and so on. And each time there's been a trough, you know, while I was waiting to find some new way to write. Right now, I am writing poetry still, despite the fact that I've got this book out. And working on new things. And I don't see anything very new happening at the moment, though I like some of the things I'm doing.
I once read that, or heard you say, that you didn't think that you wrote anything worthwhile until you were 47 years old. So when I got this 400-plus page book that spans 60 years of your writing, I wondered about you, and I wondered how much you had to let go. Is this final product a reflection of who you are now or who you were as you evolved as a poet?
Well, both. But probably the age of 47, in terms of this book, is about a quarter of the way through it. I began writing poetry when I was very young. When I was 14 is when I decided I wanted to be a poet the rest of my life, and then I've gone and done it. The earliest poem I've included here is something I believe I began when I was 18, and then the second one I remember because it was breaking up with a girl, and I was 20 then. But you get up to 47 before very many pages, really. That was the time when I moved from the academic world, where I was teaching at the University of Michigan, when I moved with Jane to New Hampshire. And she and I just lived in that house as a kind of double solitude, her in one room, me in another, working on our poems all the time. I did do other things as well, but I worked on poems every day, first thing in the day, in the morning. That was the without which nothing, sine qua non. I had to work with the poems first of all. And then I worked on other things that sort of paid the mortgage and paid college tuitions and so on.
Now, you met Jane Kenyon, your late wife and fellow poet, about halfway through your writing career. Do you see a marked difference between the writing you did before and after she came into your life?
Yes, really. I was in a bad troth about the time she and I got married. I had been from before I knew her. There were a bad 5 years in there. And then after Jane and I married, and literally were living together, that autumn, a few months after we were married, was when I wrote Kicking the Leaves and a lot of the poems of Kicking the Leaves. And when my last selected poems came out, review after review, if they liked the poem, said that when I left Michigan and moved to New Hampshire was when my poetry really began to flower. And I'd published 5 books, I think, by that time. And when I come to do this selected poems, I really have a small room for the first 3 or 4 books. They don't take up very many pages. I worked like hell. I worked a lot. I published a lot and so on. I suppose this book, which is a big book, includes about half of the poems I've published, no more than that. But more of them are more recent. And Jane's excellence and the fact that she kept getting better and better. She was a talented kid when we were married, and she became something like a great poet, finally. And watching that happen and seeing it bit by bit was enormously exciting and stimulating to me. And I wanted to be that good, you know, so I worked like crazy. And then later along, in the last 5 or 6 years of her life, I began to write poems that were as unlike Jane Kenyon poems as possible. I think that we, obviously, two poets in the same house, had the potential problem of competition or mutual imitation. Or I worked hard at being as little like her as possible. Then after she died, I didn't have that prohibition anymore, and I began even to use some words that she had used. It was as if I was writing for two by that point.
Would you mind reading something for us?
No, I'll read a poem that I was just thinking of when I said that, because I used some of her words. And it was the first poem I began after her death. She had leukemia for 15 months, and we knew her chances were poor, but we only discovered that she would actually die the last 11 days. And about a month after her death, I wrote Weeds and Peonies. Your peonies burst out, white as snow squalls, with red flecks at their shaggy centers, in your border of prodigies by the porch. I carry one magnanimous blossom indoors and float it in a glass bowl, as you used to do. Ordinary pleasures, contentment recollected, blow like snow into the abandoned garden, overcoming the daisies. Your blue coat vanishes down Pond Road into imagined snowflakes, with Gus at your side, his great tail swinging. But you will not reappear, tired and satisfied, and grief's repeated particles suffuse the air, like the dog yipping through the entire night, or the cat stretching awake, then curling, as if to dream of her mother's milky nipples. A raccoon dislodged a geranium from its pot. Flowers, roots, and dirt lay upended in the back garden where lilies begin their daily excursions above stone walls in the season of old roses. I paced beside weeds and snowy peonies, staring at Mount Kearsarge, where you climbed wearing purple hiking boots. Hurry back. Be careful climbing down. Your peonies lean their vast heads westward as if they might topple. Some topple. In that first stanza, I have prodigies and magnanimous, both words that Jane used in some of her best poems.
That image of the peonies toppling over, yeah, also reminds me a lot of her poetry.
It does. It does.
Well, Donald Hall, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed myself.
Donald Hall, former New Hampshire Poet Laureate and member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. His newest book is White Apples and the Taste of Stone, collected poems from 1946 to 2006. The Front Porch is produced by Andrew Walsh and Liz Bulkley. I'm Shay Zeller, and I'd like to remind you that everything you hear on The Front Porch is made possible by the generosity of listeners, by members. And during the spring membership drive, I'd like to encourage you to become a member. Do it tonight. Thanks very much if you've already made a pledge, and if you haven't, I hope to hear from you right now. Thanks so much.